If I were to tell you, or a friend were to tell you, tomorrow morning at noon, or tomorrow afternoon at noon, I want you to go to the corner of East Washington and Milwaukee Street and just stand there, what would you say? I hope you would ask why. But then your friend, right, would insist, no, just do it. Just go there. Just be there. And you would press back, no, why do I have to do it? For what reason? For what purpose? Why? Right? That's a logical question. It's a question we should be expected to ask. And yet, we're so quick to ask why questions about little things, but we never ask why questions about big things. It's so easy for us to get caught up in the humdrum of day-to-day living, week-to-week, month-to-month, years fly by, and we're so fast in our lives, we never stop and say, why? And this is why this book is here. Because it forces us to ask, not why is it here, it forces us to ask questions of meaning. Why? Why are we here? What am I supposed to do in this life? And why am I doing what I'm doing? Let me warn you, this is not a book that's going to inspire us to walk out of here with smiling faces a lot, but it will be a helpful book. It is the third book in what I consider the wisdom literature of the Bible. Some consider more, but Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. And it seems to me the right way to read those books is not individually, but as three chapters of a single book in the Bible. There are three chapters of what's called wisdom literature. It's a different type of genre. It's a different way of writing. It's oftentimes, like in Job and Ecclesiastes, it's the teaching is cyclical. It keeps saying the same thing over and over again. It just seems to hard to figure out. And if you read those books without understanding that and other things about them, you'll misunderstand it. You won't get the meaning of it. Ecclesiastes is certainly one of those books. Today, we're going to look at the introduction. It's important for us to understand that this book is divided up into three basic parts. There's a prologue, then there's a large body, which is most of chapter 1, half of chapter 1 through chapter 12. And then there's an epilogue. There's a beginning and an end, and then there's a lot of stuff in between. Now, some people say that Solomon wrote the book, which is what it seems to assume. Some people say there are more than one author. It doesn't really matter. The point is that it's here, and it's given to us by God to understand things about life. It causes us, as we go through life, to stop and to look back. And this Ecclesiastes, what Ecclesiastes does is it rises up to the mountains and causes us to look back this way over life and this way over life and ask a lot of questions. And it brings us to answers. So if you'll notice real quickly, there are bookends here. The writer, the author, begins in verse 2 by saying, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." That's one bookend. Then if you go to chapter 12, the very end, look in verse 8, there's another bookend. It's the same thing. Chapter 12, verse 8 says, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity." And then there's the end part, which is a concluding statement. It summarizes what has been taught. And as over the next few weeks, we're going to travel through this book, and we're going to try to keep coming back to the meaning, and we'll try to figure out and answer and figure out some questions to life here. Today, we're going to look at two things. There's an observation that the teacher or preacher, by the way, your translation, most of your translations probably have preacher or teacher. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem." It may be preacher, it may be teacher. It's a word that's used a word, it comes from a word that means assembling or gathering. So most people think it's referring to someone who teaches when people are gathered. So it's someone who may have sat and taught this. We don't really know. But that's just for your own context there. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. He makes a statement in verses 2 and 3, and then he proves that statement. He makes a conclusion about life. It's more than a statement, it's an observation. It's a conclusion. After having lived life, we would presume that the teacher is of age. After having lived life, and having heard of other people's experiences, and seen other people's lives, and saw what's going on in the world, he makes this conclusion. And it's really very straightforward. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? In order to understand this, there are three words we need to grasp here. The first, obviously, is vanity. He says it several times in the one verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It is not like we're commonly associated. Vanity as self-admiration, self-absorption. You know, I bet you think this song is about you. That kind of vanity, that's not what he's talking about. And he's not talking, I don't think he's necessarily saying either. I think as the NIV translates it, as meaningless. I don't think he's necessarily saying that life is meaningless. Because as we'll see, the wind serves a purpose. The sun serves a purpose. We serve a purpose. There's purpose here. He's not saying meaningless as in the absence of purpose. He's saying a bit more. The Hebrew word literally means wind, breath, vapor. It's that idea. So if you imagine when you step outside tomorrow morning and you breathe, what will you see? You'll see your breath. Now, can you grab your breath? Have you ever tried? I've tried. It doesn't work. There is an appearance of something there, but there's not. It's gone before you can grab it, right? There's not enough substance there for you to hold on to it. It's temporary. This is what he's saying. This is the meaning behind this word. He's saying that life is here today and gone tomorrow. Life is short. Life is temporary. In the big scheme of things, what is the meaning of it? What is the use of it? So there's vanity. We'll see that word several times. He mentions it 30 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. So we have plenty of opportunities to dive more into what it means. Then there's another word we need to understand. It's toil. He says, verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Toil at which he works under the sun, depending upon your translation. The Hebrew word indicates hard, not just work, but hard work, a drudgery. And it is possible that this is a financial term, which means left over. It's like at the end of the month, how much of your check is left over? After you pay the bills, after you buy groceries, after you put gas into your car, how much is left over? So he's asking, what does man gain? What is left over after he toils under the sun? A good translation of it is says, you spend your life working, laboring, and what do you have to show for it? Maybe that's a question you've asked before. Maybe you're asking that question right now. You know, I've worked for how many years now? And what do I have to show for it? This book is going to help us. And then there's another phrase, which is probably the most important besides vanity, and it comes at the end of verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? It's a very important phrase in Ecclesiastes. It's mentioned almost as many times as vain is. I think it's mentioned 20, maybe 29 times. And on the face of it, it doesn't appear to be much. But when we contrast it with another word that's used in the Old Testament, another phrase that's used in the Old Testament, the meaning becomes a little bit clearer. Here, Ecclesiastes says, under the sun. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, we hear the phrase, under heaven. And there's a difference between the two. Listen to some of these verses that the writers use of under the heaven. Exodus chapter 17 says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek under heaven." Who's talking? God. What's he talking about? Something that he's going to do in our world. Deuteronomy chapter 7. "The Lord your God is in your midst, a great and awesome God." This is Moses speaking on behalf of God. "The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You may not make an end of them all at once, lest the wild beasts grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will give them over to you and throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. And he will give their kings into your hand, and you shall make their name perish from under heaven. No one will be able to stand against you." Again, who's talking? It's Moses speaking on behalf of God, reminding him of what God has said and what's going on. God is acting. God is moving. God is doing something. God is reigning. Then Deuteronomy chapter 9, "The Lord said to me, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stubborn people. Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven." We should know that reference. What's going on? Who's speaking? God is speaking. And what's going on? He's acting. He's reigning. He's exercising his sovereignty over his creations. There are others. And then Deuteronomy 29. "The Lord will not be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will smoke against that man, and the curses written in this book will settle upon him, and the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven." Again, who's speaking? God is speaking. What's going on? He's acting. He's doing things. He's reigning over his creation. So we can gather these two things about the phrase under heaven. One, it is a world in which God is present. And not only that, it is a world in which God reigns. He does as he pleases. It is a world lived under God. Now we come back to Ecclesiastes. He says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? There's a difference. He doesn't use the phrase under heaven. He's talking about a world lived apart from God, a world lived regardless of God. He's talking about a world that's lived without maybe not the knowledge of God or not paying attention to God. There's no mention of heaven. In fact, with the picture of the sun, he gives us an idea of sweltering heat. You're living a life that's hard. It's a life with no consideration of God. Instead, you're living only in the observable world, only on those things you can see. It's not a world in which God is reigning, in which God is present. Maybe it'll be easier if I show you another contrast. Flip over to Psalm 104. Actually, you want to put, if it's possible, put one hand in Ecclesiastes and turn over to Psalm 104, and we'll flip back and forth to compare something. The Psalms are the worship liturgy for Israel. It's the children of God writing for the children of God as they reflect on God, they sing songs about God, as they write poetry, as they worship God. Psalm 104, Psalm 104, verse 10. Speaking of God, it says, "You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work." Then go back to verse 7 of Ecclesiastes 1. And after observing the same thing, the writer says, "All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again." What is he observing? Just the natural course of the water. There's no mention of God. There's no consciousness of God causing the springs to gush forth, causing them to flow between the hills, using them to give drink. Go back to Psalm 104. Verse 14. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. Now flip over to Ecclesiastes chapter 1 again. Verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he works or toils under the sun? In fact, flip, go down to chapter 2 and verse 18. And the teacher says, I hated all my work in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over the toil of my labors under the sun. It's quite a different picture. And the one, the writer of Ecclesiastes is lamenting the fact that he works and he labors and there's nothing to show for it. The psalmist, under them, when they're worshiping God, he praises God and thanks him that he causes grass to grow. He gives man plants to cultivate, plants to eat, so forth. Then chapter 104 of Psalm, verse 19, this is the last one or two more. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. Then go back over to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 5. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The word hastens there is literally pants. And it's the idea of the sun being tired of its work because it doesn't go around. The sun rises, it sets, it rises, it sets, it rises, it sets, and wears itself out. But here in Psalm 104, there's purpose behind it. God made the moon to mark the seasons, the sun to know its time for setting. And then the last one, verse 24 of Psalm 104. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Then verse 31, may the glory of the Lord endure forever, and may the Lord rejoice in his works. This is the conclusion. After observing all of nature, after observing the God behind all of nature, and God reigning over all of his creations sovereignly, the psalmist can't help but to praise God and say, may the glory of the Lord endure forever. But in Ecclesiastes, when the teacher observes nature, he says it's vanity. What's the use? See, the writer of Ecclesiastes wants us to feel the weight of the curse in chapter 3. Let me remind you of that. God says to Adam, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you should not eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. The writer of Ecclesiastes feels the force of that and wants us to feel that, and he says, what's the point? We're going to end up dust anyway. I don't know if you've ever built a sandcastle on the beach. It's a great joy. I mean, I love doing it. But there's something amazing about sandcastles. No matter how early in the morning you begin, and no matter how many tools you take out to the beach to build, no matter how big you make it, no matter how many hours you spend investing in it, in the morning it's going to be gone. If you go to the same place that once had a huge, massive sandcastle, and people can make sculptures and incredible things out of sand, but in the morning, they always succumb to the high tide. If you go back to where the sandcastle was, you'll never know it was there. In fact, you'll never remember the spot where it even was. Because the tide washes in, and the water smooths out all the sand, making it just as flat as pavement. This is what the writer is saying. He's saying, think about your life for a second. Think about all the things that you're investing in. Think about all the work, all the labor, all the toil that you, all the time and effort and money and brains and everything, all your resources, everything. One day it's all going to be dust. What is it for? And you might say, well, you know, after I'm gone, my family will remember you. But what about when your immediate family dies? What about when their family dies? What about 400 years ago to later? What about 1,000 years later? Even if an archaeologist were to uncover your bones, he wouldn't know your name. And you say, well, what about all the causes I'm investing in? You know, I'm not just living a hedonistic lifestyle. I'm not just living for myself and for my pleasure. I'm investing in causes. I'm investing in people. They're going to be gone too. He's saying if you look at life from just this perspective, if you look at life as a world without God, with no God, what is the use? Because in the end, it's all going to be just like that beach. It's going to be swept clean and it's going to be nothing. This is his point. Is everybody happy now? Everybody? There are purposes for writing this book. The writer has one of them, I think, is largely, I'm becoming convinced, it's largely an apologetic work. It's a work for Israel to strengthen them, to help them to not turn maybe to the pagan nations, not follow their ways. But also it may be an apologetic work for those who are in the nations, and it's certainly for us in the day and time in which we live, in which there's so many people traveling on the train of life with no clue to God. And the question for them to answer is, what is it all for? What's the use when it's all going to be swept away sooner or later anyway? If you live in a world without God, what is the purpose? No matter how much time and effort and money and resources you pour into your life, no one's going to remember it, because we're all going back to dust. He just doesn't make the case. He gives us evidences. He gives us 7 or 8 evidences here. This is what follows in verses 4 through 11. He begins by talking about, he lists the generations of man, the sun, the wind, the streams, and let's look at these individually. He says a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. What he's saying is that people are born, and people die every day, and the world just keeps turning. The world has no remembrance of you. One wave of generations come, another wave of generations come, another wave of generations come, and, you know, the earth is still here. It's a reflection of what God says in the curse: from dust you came, and dust to dust you will return. Then in verse 5, he says, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. I've already said that that is it's a picture of the sun tiring itself out, rising. We know it doesn't rise. Instead, he's picturing what it looks like, what it sees. He says, where the sun rises, the sun sets every day, the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. Repetition. You have repetition in your life? Do you do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again? Of course you do. Verse 6, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. On its circuits, the wind returns. He's saying the wind's blowing, but where's it going? It's just going in circles. What is it doing? It's just blowing around. We can observe it, and we can learn things from it, and that make life a little easier, as far as when the storms are coming and when tornadoes and all that kind of stuff. But he's saying, why does it keep blowing around? Just constant repetition. Verse 7. Streams. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they all flow again. He's saying that rivers are constantly flowing into the sea, but the sea is never full. Now we know that's the water evaporates. But there again, that's another cycle. It's just an endless cycle, endless cycle, endless cycle. He's picturing our life. And then he turns from there, after making this point, this observation in nature, he turns to apply it directly to us. He says in verse 8, all things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. He's talking about human activity. He's saying eyes never see enough. How much do your eyes, I would venture to say nobody's ever thought about this, but how many images do your eyes take in every day? And what do you do tomorrow? You get up and do it all over again. And what do you do the next? You get up and do it all over again. And sometimes we torture ourselves and just sit down purposefully in front of the television and watch. And we just take it all in. This is what he's saying. The eyes never see enough. He says, ears are never full. How much do we hear every day? How much do we listen to? Who we listen to people, we listen to music, we listen to radio, we listen to, you know, their iPods. There's constant sound going into our ears. But just like the sea, they never fill up. Our ears never fill up. Then he turns to human history in verse 9. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. Now, just for a second, he's generalizing here. He's not making a strict application. He's not saying there is nothing ever new in the world. He's generalizing. That's what they do a lot of times in wisdom literature. If you remember Proverbs, that's how they teach. That's how they talk. He doesn't deny new inventions, but he just points out this fact that almost always they're built upon the shoulders of people who have toiled before them. Steve Jobs didn't invent the phone. He designed the iPhone. And before that, there was something. Before that, there was something. Before that, and it just keeps building. Communication. This is what he means. There's nothing new under the sun. Sometimes there's rediscoveries of something old. You know, there's only so many ways you can style hair. There's only so many different styles for jeans. You know, there's only so many things in the world, and they get recycled over and over and over and over again. This is what he's saying. That's why I'm clinging to the plaid. If it's not in style now, it will be. And what he's saying here is that history mirrors the repetitive, futile, almost cycles that we see in nature. Is there a baby? There's one before the next day. Is there a death? It's already been done. Is there a war? That's already been done too. Then in verse 11, final evidence is in those who come before us and those who are after us, human posterity. It says in verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. He's saying, like we said before, 40 years from now, who will remember this generation? 400 years from now, who will remember this generation? 1,000 years from now, if we live that long, who will remember this generation? We're not very good with history, is what he's saying. You know, for instance, the Beatles, probably, arguably, the most talented and popular group of all time. There are estimates that they have sold 1 billion records. I think John Lennon made the statement, Christianity will go, it will vanish and shrink. I'm right, I'll be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. Now let's do this test in your own heads. Who here who is 40 years older can name the Fab Four? Don't raise your hand. Okay, who here 30 years and older can name the Fab Four? Who here 20 years? How about teenagers? How about kids younger than that? That's his point. We forget. We forget. And sooner or later, I'm sure it's already happened, people will be saying, the Beatles? What are the Beatles? This is why he says, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to come. No matter how you live your life, a time is coming in which it will all be washed away by the tide. So what's the point? That's what he forces us to ask, and he's forcing those of us who live outside of God's, those who live outside of God's, who claim to live outside of God's reign, who claim to live without God, he's forcing them into their logical conclusion. What's the point then? If everything's going to be gone, and there is no God, and there is no rhyme or reason to anything, why are we living? And we'll see him work this out throughout the book. There's a lot of action in the world, which is what he shows us through all the nature and everything. There's a lot of action, but not a lot of change. There's a lot of work, but there's not much new. There's a lot of work, as we can attest to, but a lot of repetition, doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, and then we die. So where is God at in this? Well, he isn't. That's the point. He doesn't mention God in these first 11 verses. He mentions God throughout. He brings him up, and he brings him up to make a point. And then we see him appear every now and then. He comes back. He brings us back to God. And then at the end, chapter 12, turn to chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. Verse 13, he says this, the end of the matter, after all has been heard, is this, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, with every secret thing, whether good or evil. He's saying life isn't futile. It isn't vain when you understand that there is a God. There is a God to be obeyed. There's a God to know. There's a God to understand. And this God gives us lots of things in this life, as we're going to see. He gives us work, which is a gift from him. He gives us relationships. He gives us pleasures. He gives us all kinds of things. And God will call us into account one day, every single one of us, whether we live with the knowledge of him or not, he will call us into account with how we've used those gifts. Because the point is not the gifts. The point is knowing the one who's given us the gifts. The point is not to become so consumed with work that you lose sight of God. The point is to do your work in view of God. Because they are a tool, they are a means to rejoicing in and knowing the one who's given them to you. This is the point of Ecclesiastes. When we get to chapters 2 and chapter 3, we'll see that the teacher tried to invest himself wholeheartedly into his work. He tried to invest himself wholeheartedly into knowing and knowledge and wisdom, but he understood that it's futile. And I think the point is that when we have to live life in view of the fact that God has given us these things, not as an end in themselves, but as a means to an end. Means to the end. God is the end. Knowing God is the end. Rejoicing and loving, knowing God is the end. These are not the end. This life is not the end, as we'll see. Since God does exist, we're already at the end. Since God does exist and is sovereign over life, there are two unavoidable conclusions to this, and then we'll close with this. The one is that life lived apart from God is vanity. If you remember the parable that Jesus told us in Luke chapter 12 of the rich fool, he said, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.'" That should sound familiar if you've read through Ecclesiastes. "Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, 'You fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, the things you have built, the things you have invested in, whose will they be when you're gone? Because you've spent your life investing in yourself.'" Then Jesus concludes with this point: "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." If you live life apart from God, you have no God to invest in but yourself. And that, Ecclesiastes says, and that, Jesus says, is foolish. You end up becoming a slave and you don't even realize it. Because we're enslaved, and this is what Ecclesiastes, I think, may bring out. We become enslaved to this world. We become a slave. We work to gain something that doesn't last. If life is lived apart from God, we think and plan and build things that one day will be destroyed. We love, we serve, and invest in people who one day will pass away too. But we have to keep doing these things because there's no other alternative. This is all we know. We're enslaved. We have to. If not, we'll go mad. Our world will be meaningless and we'll be purposeless and there'll be nothing to this life. And this is what Jesus hints at when he says, "What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his own soul?" You forfeited your soul. But the other unavoidable conclusion is that living for God infuses this life with meaning. Because this life is not the end, and this life is only temporary, but God is the end, and God is eternal. And knowing Him infuses everything. It infuses our work, it infuses our recreation, it infuses our relationships, it infuses everything with eternal purpose. This is why Paul can say in 1 Corinthians, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Let's pray. Father, we thank you for sending your Son to rescue us from vanity. Rescue us from foolishness. Rescue us from slavery to the things of this world. And rescue us from slavery to sin so that we might know you. So that we might be able to love you and worship you. So we might be able to love other people rightly and serve them and be kind to them. Rather than seeing them as means to our end. I pray that you would strike us afresh with a sense of your sovereignty over all of life. And help us to see the world as and see our daily labors and see our work and see our families and see our relationships and see everything in this world that you've given to us. Help us to see them as being infused with meaning because they come from you. And prevent us from ever seeing them or treating them as the end because they're not. They're just temporary. In Christ's name we pray, amen.